Stephen Brent, who may or may not be in the audience of the Anchorage Daily News, indirectly yesterday accused me of speaking in the abstract. I think that's probably a fair assessment. I did tell you that there were going to be two chapters to this gospel, and the first chapter had to be one that was abstract, I think, in order to try, I hoped, to stretch your minds a little bit about what it would mean to look at the city as a systems opportunity. I said today would be a sequel, so I have to tell you a sequel to the story of Moses that I began with yesterday. That's particularly appropriate to Alaska. Seems that a speaker like me, who was an expert on Moses in this case, went to Israel a few years ago and was giving a lecture on Moses. And a young man in the back, about where Keith is, spoke up and said, Moses was a think. And the lecturer, being a good lecturer, simply ignored him. After a few more minutes, the young man said again, Moses was a think. And finally, the lecturer decided he couldn't ignore him anymore. And he said, young man, don't you know it's not polite to heckle a speaker? And the young man said, I don't care, Moses was a think. And he said, all right, why was Moses a think? And he said, isn't he the leader who led the children of Israel out of Egypt to the promised land? And the speaker said, of course. And wasn't he the one who took them across the Red Sea? And he said, yes. And he says, he was a think. If he turned right instead of left, we'd have the oil instead of the desert. Well, you've got the oil. Now the question is, what do we do with it? So I intend to be fairly practical today, I hope, Mr. Brent. I'd like to begin by telling you sort of a quasi-true story about a conversation with my wife a few weeks ago. Her name is Lois, and we have four children. And I said, Lois, let's sit down and talk about our future. And she said, don't bug me. I've got supper to fix. PTA meeting is tonight. Dickie needs to go to the dentist to have his teeth fixed. And I said, yes, I know we got all those problems, but if we don't look at our future and start thinking of alternatives, she said, all right, what do you mean? And I said, well, what should be our goals? Should we assume that the quality of life we have now and our standard of living would be what we should have? And she said, what do you mean? And I said, that's what I want to ask you. What do you think our future ought to be? Should we try to raise our standard of living? And she said, sure. And I said, well, how will we know if it's going to be better a few years from now than it is now? She said, that's easy. We'll have more money. And I said, Lois, will that buy us happiness? our good health? Our love? She said, well, no, let's keep things the way they are now, because I like them that way. And I like the relationship we have and our children. And I said, Lois, change is inevitable. Our children are going to grow up. They're going to go to college, and they're going to leave home. You and I are going to grow older. And some of the things that we have are going to wear out and need to be replaced. That same thing's true for you, isn't it, here in Alaska? Change is inevitable. So the question isn't whether or not there will be change, whether or not you will get older, whether or not there will be more of you, whether or not some of you will leave. Change is going to occur. That's the one thing that seems to me that we can be relatively certain of. And therefore, the question that faces Lois and myself, and that faces Alaska, is do we want to try to do something to affect the kinds of changes that will occur, to channel the direction of those changes, or are we going to wait until the change occurs and then really readapt our lifestyles or adapt to the vicissitudes of life as they come along? For a family, it's not always possible to control the kinds of changes. For a collection of people, 280,000 some strong in a very large state with a kitty of money, it should be possible to hedge some of the bets with respect to the kinds of changes that will occur. One thing I think we can be certain of with change is that whether we want it to be or not, whether it's comfortable for us to be so or not, that the kind of change, the pace of change in which we're involved in now is new. And I'd like to read a brief quotation from Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist, who says that this world of ours is a new world in which the unity of knowledge, the nature of human communities, the order of society, the order of ideas, the very notions of society and culture have changed and will not return to what they have been in the past. What is new not because it has never been there before, but because it has changed in quality. One thing that is new is the prevalence of newness, the changing scale and scope of change itself, so that the world alters as we walk in it, so that the years of a man's life measure not some small growth or a rearrangement or moderation of what he learned in childhood, but a great upheaval. The world in which you and I exist is in the process of a great upheaval. I believe, from what I've seen, that Alaska's great upheaval is exacerbated by the present status of the major changes which are now going to occur within your state. So that change not only is inevitable, change is likely to come in quantum jumps, in gulps. Whether or not you allow change to occur without any attempt to direct its course, or whether you attempt to guide the change in a direction which will attempt to match the quality of the man-made environment to the superb quality you have inherited in your natural environment is an issue before you. Or whether or not you are willing to harness your pioneering spirit and quest for challenge to making the man-made environment a thing of beauty and a joy forever, as well as preserve the natural environment, is a question before you. Or whether you are willing to live in squalor amidst the splendors of nature, as some of you at least inferred to me you would be willing to do, is something which should be individual choice. But I suggest, as responsible citizens, and particularly the legislature, which is responsible not only for all of us now, but for future generations, that there ought to be an alternative set of choices beyond that for those who will be living here in the future. I suspect, therefore, that you want to do something about the man-made environment as well as preserve the natural environment. But more than hoping for a better future is needed if you wish to provide hope for those who will be here in the future. More than wishing that things will be adequate or better is needed. The decisions you make or do not make will determine the future of your man-made environment. Let me attempt to list some of the forces which I believe are now at work that will inevitably bring about change in the technology of building our urban places. Now, I'm not going to go back and try to redefine those terms because that's what I dealt with in my abstract talk yesterday. Briefly, the ways of making our urban places. First of all, let's take a look at that thing called city, whether it's Anchorage or Buffalo or Washington, D.C., and let's try to explore what the basic inventions are that man has made in the last decade or last century or so, which have changed the physical form of that city from what it had been for thousands of years. I think they're a relatively short list. First of all was the invention of steel, steel-making processes, and its reduction to steel frames for skyscrapers in order that buildings could be pushed up higher than in the air than it was possible to do with masonry. It's the first time in the history of the world that it was possible to build buildings taller than 5 or 6 floors. The next invention that was absolutely necessary in order to utilize the steel frame was the elevator. People aren't likely to walk up steps when the buildings get more than 4 or 5 stories high, and if they don't have to. The next invention, which was really a reduction of practice, was the one I mentioned yesterday, namely indoor plumbing. The next invention was actually first the discovery of electricity, but then the important invention of the electric light and some other appliances that utilized that electrical energy in order that rooms like this were usable. This room depends on electricity and artificial light making it possible to be utilized. Not every room, therefore, in a tall building in a dense urban place has to have windows and exterior light. The next invention, I would argue, was the telephone. In order that it was possible for people to communicate by not having to be face-to-face or by not having to physically transmit a message. And that made it possible for hundreds of thousands of people to aggregate in a place called Manhattan, for example. And then the invention of the automobile. In order that movement could occur reasonably within congested areas. And then the invention of the subway, when the automobile became so dense that it no longer was effective as it happens in Manhattan. On one I left out, central heating. If you can imagine a 30-story apartment building in which was necessary to design a fireplace for every room, that's bad enough, but imagine the logistics problem of trying to get fuel to the fireplace in every room in a 30-story building in order to provide heat. So central heating was necessary. Well, that list of inventions was some 10 or 12. The important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that every one of those inventions were reduced to practice in 12 years, between 1880 and 1892. And there has not been another single goddamn invention since 1892 to change the physical character of what a city is. And if we were to turn as a society to those people to whom we would reasonably turn for new inventions, we find something interesting. Remember that I said technology was men, institutions, resources, and rules. The institutions which surround those people to whom we would turn, not quite naturally, are institutions like the American Institute of Architects, the American Society of Civil Engineers, the American Society of Heating Engineers, the American Society of Electrical Engineers, the National Fire Prevention Association, the American Standards Association, a list of about 50 institutions, every one of which was formed 5 or 10 years either side of that 12 years of invention. And if we say, how about the universities that are producing the new skilled men that are coming into the marketplace, we'll find in the South 48 states that practically every major engineering school and every architectural school was founded somewhere 5 or 10 years either side of that 12 years of invention. And if we look at the structure of local city government in every city in the United States that's any size, that was formed before the turn of the century, which is practically every city, we'll find that there's a guy responsible for structural strength in buildings. There's a man who's responsible for elevators. There's a man who's responsible for water and sewer, which is part of the plumbing system invention. There's a man who's responsible for heating appliances. There's a man who's responsible for electricity. There's a man who's responsible for telephone systems. There's a man who's responsible for the highways and automobiles. There's a man who's responsible for the subway. It's no damn wonder. The institutional paraphernalia of our society perpetuates that 12 inventions. That just is not going to be an adequate list of inventions in the balance of this century, because the performance requirements that are possible to be realized for urban places, for cities, as they begin to become politically viable, And as entrepreneurs begin to generate whole new corporations and whole new businesses, which address themselves to the production, not of that list of things I just talked about, but to the production of urban places, based on those performance criteria, we're going to have, I predict, another burst of major inventions like we had between 1880 and 1892 that are going to change the nature of what the physical hardware systems of urban places are. The history of invention is interesting from that standpoint. The automobile wasn't invented by people in the railroad business. The airplane wasn't invented by people in the automobile business. The computer wasn't invented by people in the business equipment business. Man-made textiles, nylon, rayon, fiberglass, weren't developed by people in the textile business. Every time there's been a major invention, there's been an invasion. One industry invades another industry, or a whole new set of industries is formed around that invention, and the old industries either atrophy or lose their share of the market. I think it's reasonable to assume that that will be the case in the next 30 years as well, because if a new set of inventions for a new set of urban hardware systems are generated out of the performance requirements of our cities, there'll be a new set of companies which address themselves to those problems and those opportunities. The performance, another force at work, the population explosion. That isn't a myth. It isn't a conjecture. It isn't an abstract speculation. The babies are already here. And of all people, architects should have been sensitive to this. Because 15 years ago, most architects had commissions to design elementary schools. And about 10 years ago, they had commissions to design junior high schools. And 8 years ago, it was high schools. And now, in the last 5 years, it's been junior colleges and colleges. That wave of babies is moving. That wave of babies is about to come out of the colleges. And in the 70s, they're going to want homes, schools for their kids, places to work, and churches. And all of the predictions that you've seen, you know, I think are realistic. We will have to build as many buildings in the United States in the next 30 years as we've already built since the country was founded. Now, that's a large-scale technological problem. It's not a design problem in the sense that architects talk about design, I don't think. It's a design problem in the sense that one talks about technology. How do you organize the men, the institutions, the resources, and the rules which relate them in a way in which it will be possible, not to do it necessarily more efficiently, not to do it so that it's more eloquently done, not to do it so that it's more effective, but even to do it at all, because we don't really have models for how to organize that large-scale activity at all. And if it's done by people who have no concern, which is possible, for the quality of life, then I'm not going to be very happy. Peter Drucker, who's John tells me sometimes a Brookings, or has been historically a Brookings staff member, has wrote a very interesting book, which Ed Higbee's theme is reflected in. It's called The Age of Discontinuity. And I wanted to read you one paragraph in this book about technology, which reinforces what Ed was saying to you. It should already be clear that the new technologies, with the industries based on them, are the only means for today's developed countries, above all the United States, to maintain their present standard of living and economic health. Not that it's a good idea, that it's an entrepreneurial venture. It's the only way, he argues, to maintain our present standard of living and economic health. The new industries use product productively the resources in which developed countries have had an advantage, that is, educated people. These industries are, one and all, knowledge industries, using large numbers of knowledge workers and producing goods and services with a high knowledge content. The developing poor countries can become wealthier and economically strong, however, only by developing industries that have been the modern industries, quotation marks, in the developed world for the last 50 years. Modern and productive agriculture, the automobile industry, fertilizer and organic chemistry, steel and machinery. I particularly wanted to read that paragraph because of that list of modern industries. You're blessed in many ways in this state because your economy isn't based on those industries. You're not an agricultural state. You're not a state that produces steel. And you're not a state that produces automobiles, or I believe even the large chemical plants which produce chemical products. Therefore, you have a chance in this state to leapfrog many of the states in the South 48, because you have a chance to build an industrial base on the new knowledge industries. And the knowledge industries have as their technological input skilled people. And I hear, I don't know whether it's true or not, I hear that you're losing your skilled people at the younger end of the spectrum, that they go somewhere else to college and they don't come back. That's a much more important resource than your oil, it seems to me. If you're going to build the future of Alaska on the knowledge industries, the oil can provide you with some money, but what are you going to invest that money in? Are you going to invest that money in people, knowledgeable people, on which you can build a new set of industries and move into and ahead of and leapfrog some of the southern, most of the southern states in the United States that are now caught up in economies based on labor-intensive processes like steel, automobiles, and agriculture? The last force that I see at work, again, is one in which you have in spades. Because the challenge is there, there will be venturesome men who will move in to the city building business. I shouldn't even say if, because I think I'm pretty good at measuring men. When I was in the federal government, I had 800 people working for me. And in the 5 years I was there, I had to recruit more than 250 highly skilled technical people. And I'm convinced that in 3 minutes, by looking a man straight in the eye and talking to him, I can tell whether he's a good man and whether he's venturesome and whether he has guts. And there's a lot of you in this room. That's what Alaska has made a big attraction to. And venturesome men are the ones who are going to move into these new industrial opportunities based on knowledge industries, and particularly the industrial competence I'm talking about now is the competence of building communities, urban places, and cities. Ed Higby mentioned this morning that there are 74 new cities being built in the United States. That's almost true. I take that with a grain of salt, because they're not really new cities in the sense that I'm talking about it. They're new because they've never been there before. But they're not essentially new in concept. They're using the same hardware systems, that same basic set of inventions from 1880 to 1892, and they're designing the physical solutions to those cities based on that same set of inventions. And whether or not the quality of life will be better in those cities, in some sense, becomes a question of the kinds of people, obviously, who will move in there. But I think it could be much more than that. If the kind of people who moved in there also were able to exert pressure on the performance requirements for what they wanted out of the software systems and the hardware systems of a city that were translatable technologically into new solutions, then we would be building new cities. And articles like the one that John picked up here today, you know, abound these days. Construction in the 70s, and there's a picture of sort of the World's Fair imaginative view of what the city of the future is going to look like. I think that's rubbish. Why design a new product when you haven't got a process? That's something we learned in World War II in the United States. But we didn't learn it in the city building business yet. We invented, literally for the first time in the history of the world, the process of invention with the Manhattan Project, the project that made the atomic bomb. We learned that it was possible by man using his intellect in concerted activity to produce anything his mind could conceive of. Now that's different. That's not a quantum jump different. That's a discontinuity, to use Drucker's word, from what had been the past. In the past, inventions like the ones I talked about depended on the individual genius working in his laboratory or the chance excursion of a trained mind to have an idea and to have that invention then come into existence and for an entrepreneur of some kind, a business, to build on that idea. Henry Ford didn't invent the automobile. A lot of people had invented automobiles. Henry Ford was the entrepreneur that put together the organization that built the automobiles and introduced two major innovations. The first major innovation was mass production. And that's now technologically obsolete, by the way. And the second major innovation was the idea that he would pay his workers $5 a day. His board of directors said he was crazy. Henry Ford said, unless I pay my workers $5 a day, I won't have enough customers for my mass production. Because if only those who are well off in our society can buy automobiles, there won't be a big enough market for all the automobiles I'm going to be able to make. We got automobile pollution as a result of his innovation. For the first time in my history, I forgot where I was. Got so excited about Henry Ford. Let me go on and speak specifically to what are your alternatives. In the school that I started in September, we're trying to teach the systems approach. And we have a classic problem that we use to explain what it would mean to look at alternatives systematically. And the classic problem is a relatively simple statement of a problem. We have a number of streets in Buffalo in which cars are parked on a rather permanent basis in which trash collects underneath those cars. And the problem is how to take care of the fact that trash is collecting under those cars and that you can't get to it with normal street cleaning machines. Every one of the words I used becomes an alternative if you really look at a set of alternatives. It's not how can you invent little things to get under the automobile and take the leaves out. That's one alternative. Second alternative is to eliminate trash. If there were no trash, then obviously the trash wouldn't collect on the automobiles and you wouldn't have a problem. Another alternative, eliminate automobiles. If there weren't any automobiles, there wouldn't be any automobiles for trash to collect under, obviously. Second problem, eliminate streets. If there weren't any streets, there wouldn't be any automobiles, couldn't park in the streets for the trash to collect under. Unless you're prepared to look at a problem or an opportunity with that set of alternatives, you haven't really explored the alternatives. And so the first alternative that's available to the state of Alaska is to do nothing. Absolutely nothing. And since that's not likely, The second alternative is to do nothing special about the man-made environment. Just let it happen, the way it's evidently been accumulating over the past century. Alaska isn't unique in that. That's true generally around the world and in the United States particularly. The second alternative is to plan new cities and plan to replace the old cities. And that's what I call a product approach. This reminds me of where I was before. The invention of the process of invention. The product approach, I think, has limitations, which are no longer necessary. Because when we invented the process of invention in the Manhattan Project, we then applied it to two other major efforts within our society, the Polaris submarine and NASA, the development of the space program. And what we did not do when we began the space program is crucial here. In 1958, when the Russian satellite went beep beep, and we got all excited, and we organized legislation, we established our goal, whether reasonable or not, that we wanted man to get to the moon by the end of that decade, by the end of the decade of the 60s. We did not go out and hire an industrial designer, an engineer, and an anthropologist of some sort and say, design us a space vehicle to get man to the moon and we'll go out and get bids on it. We knew that that was patently ridiculous and impossible. We didn't know enough at that point. Our ignorance was too large to design the solution to the problem. We could state the problem, we could state the goal, namely to get man to the moon, but we couldn't conceive of what the solution was until we organized the processes of invention, until we made a huge investment. We gambled, in a sense, $5 billion the second year of NASA's life, that we could organize the scientific and technological skills of our nation to get at the answers to those things that we didn't know systematically, in order that as we accumulated answers to those unknowns, we could then begin to conceive of solutions. And we had to find out questions like, what sort of thrust was it going to take to get beyond Earth's gravitational field? And what sort of environment was man going to